You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early, so everyone can go home on time. There's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
What's up, friends? Welcome back to another episode of the New Evangelicals Podcast. I gotta say, I've been getting on guests, at least for me, that I've really enjoyed talking to. I hope that you've enjoyed them. And this episode is no different. I have Megan Madsen on the podcast. She is a theologian who focuses a lot on the Wesleyan tradition, which, interestingly enough, has a lot of roots in early evangelicalism. And we talk about, you know, why social justice is actually very biblical. Megan is someone who has thought through a lot of these things biblically, who knows a lot about the Bible, and really ties together how even in Judaism, oppression and taking care of neighbor are priorities to God. And we talk a lot about that and how in our current evangelical culture, a lot of that is just missing, which are things that we've talked about a lot on our Facebook community and on the Instagram. But it's always good to have a theologian come on and talk about it from their expertise. And today is a great episode about that. So I really hope you enjoyed this episode. That being said, you know, we really are beginning to start the process of turning over a whole new chapter with New Evangelicals, which is just so exciting. A big announcement is coming September 1st, so mark your calendars for that. We're unveiling just the next steps, where we're heading, what we need, and I'm very excited for all of it. So stay tuned for that. I appreciate everyone who is sharing the podcast, who is sharing the YouTube videos, who is liking and subscribing. It means so much to us. If you can give us a rating and review on Apple Podcast, that would be a huge help. It goes so far. I gotta say, this is truly a community effort. There are people behind the scenes helping me out with show notes, with website stuff, with organization, and that's how we want to run New Evangelicals going forward, which I think is just the best way. I love the concept of a community coming together to make things happen. If you want to support the show and New Evangelicals, you can do it by clicking on one of the links below in either the YouTube, you know, show notes or on the podcast show notes. All right, friends, enough of me. Let's listen to me interview Megan. Hope you enjoy this episode. Megan, thank you for coming on. I appreciate you making time on a weeknight. It means a lot. So thank you.
Absolutely. Thanks, Tim. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, I this is another one where I've had two people and I've interviewed that I found out via Instagram. Followers, you know, messaged me saying, "Hey, get this person on." So you're number two on my list, which is great. So exactly. So I'm glad it worked out. Yes, seriously, networking. Why don't you kind of give me and some of the listeners your background? You know, did you grow up in evangelical spaces? Where are you now, etc.?
Yeah. So I grew up in very small town, rural North Idaho. So like a couple hours south of the Canadian border, backwoods town. My hometown mascot is the Lumberjacks, if that gives you a kind of like image there.
I got it.
Town of 2,600 people. So kind of grew up in this beautiful mountain valley, river valley town. And I think I grew up kind of with this, like, oh, I just can't wait to get away from here, you know?
Yeah.
And I think in some ways now, having gone through multiple So yeah, so from there, I'll come back to that. But sure. From there, I went on to college at Northwest Nazarene University down in Nampa, Idaho. Mm-hmm. Got an undergraduate degree in Christian ministries with an emphasis in pastoral ministries. So that just means I was looking to like lead pastoral ministry, not like youth ministry, children's ministry, missionary, et cetera.
Right.
After that, I served with Ben Kramer, who you've also interviewed
on
the show.
I love Ben. He's in a group chat with me and someone else. We talk almost every day. I love Ben. He's great.
Hooligan. Yeah.
Is he? He's a hooligan?
Yeah. In like the most like quiet, trolling way. Funny story about that.
Really quick, it's funny because when I first met Ben, I interviewed him. He comes like, you know, very kind of, like you said, kind of quiet. And then we're talking stoic, great word. And we're talking over text one day. He's like, oh, by the way, I'm a lead singer in this metal band. Check this out, because I'm in the metal. And I hear him like growling. I'm like, who is this Ben? So that went through me for a loop.
Yeah. So at his first church that he pastored at as a lead pastor, I was his first associate pastor. I was the youth and family discipleship pastor there.
Wow.
And our very first staff meeting together, at that point I had never seen the office. I have seen it all now since, so don't freak out in the comments, people, but I had never seen it at that point. And I say something like offhanded and sarcastic to him, and completely deadpan, he says, why are you the way that you are? I hate all of the things you choose to be. And with no context for that at all, I was like, I'm working for a psychopath. This is horrible. And he sees like the fear come into my face. And he was like, no, it's a show. It's a show. Have you not seen this?
And
sent me like links to watch The Office.
By quoting Michael Scott, he became Michael Scott in that moment.
It's exactly
what happened. And made
everything
real awkward.
Yeah. That's Ben. So yeah. So then after in undergrad, I started working for Ben. I worked there for a couple years. Mm. The church was kind of like an urban area. So I worked with primarily the youth of the church. Most of them did not grow up in the church. Most of them didn't have families that attended the church. Most of them were at or below poverty line, all those sorts of things. So I had like youth group sermons about the importance of brushing our teeth and hygiene and those sorts of things.
Wow.
Which was very different than like the adults of the church, who are mostly aged, older, very traditionally evangelical. Mm. So there was like this almost like two congregations within the church. Mm. And then shortly into my tenure there, I just realized I needed some more tools in my kit as a pastor.
Yeah.
And so realized that I needed to go to seminary and really felt led that direction by the Spirit. At that point, was feeling led to remain in the tradition, the denomination I was a part of. And so I went to the denominational seminary in Kansas City, Missouri, Nazarene Theological Seminary. And so to kind of place that denomination, it's a Wesleyan holiness tradition. So it's evangelical Wesleyan. So brought on by the ministry and theology of John Wesley and Charles Wesley. And then kind of situated itself kind of firmly within kind of evangelicalism through the culture wars. Mm. So started off with a huge impetus and a huge force for social justice, and then really got tangled up in holiness being don't do's and no's, and holiness being really a defining who's in, who's out. Mm. So went there, absolutely loved my education there, loved my time there. Was really shaped and formed by that. Started serving at a church called New Beginnings in Lee's Summit, Missouri. Yes, named for General Lee. So very much strong struggles with institutional racism in that city. And our church owned a strip mall. I pastored the youth there for a while, and then I pastored the strip mall. So the things they don't teach you in seminary are like construction bids. And that's what I did.
Yeah.
With the idea of this church moved into this strip mall, was remodeling it, was revitalizing it, was practicing justice in our community by working with local businesses and locally owned businesses. And that was our justice push. And that was our push of, we are here and this is who we're called to be, and this is what righteousness looks like.
So
I pastored there for a few years, and then met my husband while I was at seminary, felt led and called to come pastor a church in North Idaho, pastored there for a few years. And through the pandemic, God really started to open up some of those boxes about institutional justice and whether I should remain in an institution that I didn't really believe in anymore, or if I should try to make moves to depart from it. And the kind of the resounding answer through all of that was, yeah, it's time to go. That my calling wasn't to stay and try to change, but to leave and be a part of something that was already going. So I'm now going on July 1st. I start my first appointment in the United Methodist Church. So I'll be serving Covenant United Methodist in Spokane, Washington.
I think Ben also went to a Methodist church as well. So it's interesting. And I don't want to focus too long here, but the Church of the Nazarene, you know, since I've had this account, I've met quite a few people who are in that denomination, many who were pastors who have since left. And it's, you know, I can't speak on like a data-driven level if this is like a mass exodus, but certainly it seems like the people I'm talking to feel like there's a big shift happening of like, I guess, some power-hungry old white people who want to kind of keep the guard, the status quo, or the denomination, the status quo, and are kind of pushing out people who maybe are saying, hey, let's get back to our Wesleyan roots. Let's get back to, you know, a justice that is individual and corporate. And some people are just saying, no, absolutely not.
Yeah. So I will first of all start with the disclaimer that I know a lot of Nazarene pastors who are staying with the intention of shifting the narrative. I've discerned in my life that that is not my calling.
Sure.
To stay and shift. But yes, that's very much what's happening. As we kind of see this stratification in our country, right? This division of really since the 2016 election, right? Where we kind of, and what I would say is I think that election pulled the covers off of what was always there and was quiet.
That's right.
It was an unveiling. It was a revelation of this is actually who we are as the American church. And for, I think, so many of us, that was really traumatic. And that very much happened in all of our denominations as well.
So. 100%. I agree. We talk a lot about that on different podcasts and on the Instagram, that I really believe that, like, what you said is so apt. It wasn't like it came out of nowhere. It was just maybe more hidden, right? Maybe the language was softer. Maybe the wording wasn't as direct. And then 2016 was a moment where it's like, oh my God, like, this is, I mean, I really thought, and I say this a lot, but I really thought that when the comments from Trump, like the leaked audio of him talking to Access Hollywood, right? When that came out, I thought, oh, well, he's done. Like, the evangelical church is going to reject him. They'll spit him out. And I mean, who knows now? This could be a big shift, maybe a third party. I mean, who knows? Like, I'm kind of almost a little giddy at this point. And then Jerry Falwell comes out and says, you know, we need a pastor or commander-in-chief, not a pastor-in-chief. And they circle the wagons. They call it locker room talk. And they keep pushing. And for me, that was a moment where I go, something's not correct. The people who taught me never ever to even talk like that or not to look at the wrong images, not to lust after women, are now voting for a person who's on the cover of Playboy, who's had multiple affairs, and who also is threatening to sexually assault women. Something is way wrong. So I agree with you. You know, I think a lot of that stuff was really planted from like the 80s, right? From like the Jerry Falwell Moral Majority, and is it Reich, I think is his name, is his like co-host over there, Robert Reich, who kind of formed that. But can you kind of explain to us, my question to kind of start us off is, can you kind of give us a background on like this Wesleyan tradition? Because Ben talks about it a lot. You mentioned it. And I don't know if a lot of us really understand like what that tradition is, where it came from, and what it kind of stands for.
Yeah. So there are a number of denominations that draw their roots from the Wesley brothers. So John and Charles Wesley were Oxford educated Anglican vicars in the 1700s. And essentially, so they go to Oxford, they get trained. John Wesley gets sent to Georgia to do pastoral ministry there well before the American Revolution. And so he's in the colonies. And an interesting part of that is that's the first time where he sees slavery. And so he sees Black persons being enslaved and immediately responds with, but they're made in the image of God. And so later in his life, he becomes a huge a huge advocate for ending the slave trade in the British Empire. Mm. But so he sees that he, by all accounts, his ministry in Georgia was like an absolute disaster. He like was engaged to this woman and broke it off and got re-engaged several times because he was like, should pastors get married? I don't know. Yeah. And so she just ditches him, gets married. And so when she returns from her honeymoon, he bars her and her husband from the Eucharist table and won't serve them.
Oh,
except for that her father was very powerful in Georgia. And so he got sent home. On the ship home, okay. He encounters these Moravian monks. And all through his life, he's really struggled with, am I saved? Am I not saved?
Mm.
How do I know if I'm saved? It's his struggle. So while he was in Oxford studying, he forms these groups with his brother, and they have these very stringent disciplines of practicing faith.
Right.
And so they get made fun of by their colleagues, who call them methodical, hence Methodists.
Ah.
But so he's really still struggling with this, despite having started these things. And on the ship back, he sees the Moravians, and they get in a big storm, and they think the ship's going to capsize. They think they're all going to die. And he's completely freaked out. He's right. Like, I'm going to die. I don't know if I'm saved. Ah,
right.
Pure panic.
Right.
And these Moravians are just sitting on the deck, singing hymns, praying, totally at peace. And so he talks with them, and essentially one of them says, preach faith until you have faith. And that's what they give him. And they pray with him. They comfort him. He receives peace, and he continues the journey home. After a time, he goes to Aldersgate and experiences what he calls a strange warming of the heart. And so he, for the first time, believes that he is really and truly saved.
Okay.
And so then he and Charles start this movement of reform for both the country of Great Britain, the British Empire, and the Anglican Church. And so the whole thrust of it is love God, love neighbor, continue in good works.
Huh. Very
so
simple.
They kind of, very simple. And so the Methodist movement was never intended to be anything other than a movement. Within the Anglican Church. It was supposed to be a renewing order, but the American Revolution broke out, and so that's kind of how it became a denomination, is through that. But essentially, the core tenets of Wesleyanism is that it's Arminian, so we believe in free will. We believe in, all the core tenets of Orthodox Christianity. We believe in all the creeds. The special emphasis is that we genuinely believe the grace of God at work in our lives sanctifies and changes us as we continue in love with God. That we aren't stuck, as the Reformed tradition would say, sinning in word, thought, and deed for all eternity, right? For all of our lives. Wesley would really push against that and say, like, do good works. participate in love with God and love of neighbor, and you are doing good works.
Right.
That faith does work itself out in good deeds, as James's epistle tells us. So he started some of, so he gets barred from preaching at basically all of the Anglican parishes.
What a radical.
In London. Yeah, that's really, and he was deemed too radical. And so now they have statues of him outside of them. But so he gets barred from preaching. And so he says, fine, the world is my parish.
Nice.
And he just begins preaching to the crowds of miners and workers in the Industrial Revolution and early stages of that transition. Not the Industrial Revolution, sorry, but the transition into like working class peoples. He is preaching to them and starts some of the first schools for their children, founds orphanages.
Wow.
And he really works to transform the country in which he resides. So Methodism starts off just as like bands and societies of people meeting. They ask each other questions like, how is it with your soul? And what are you doing to cultivate the work of God in your life and cultivate the love of God and the love of neighbor in your life? And just encouraging each other and challenging each other.
Yeah.
And so the movement kind of just explodes and became for a long time, the largest mainline tradition in the United States. And yeah, that's kind of the basic thrust of it.
They were the first, were they some of the first to also ordain women as well?
The Wesleyan tradition has a long history of that. So the Church of the Nazarene has always ordained women since before women could vote in this country. John Wesley did encourage the leadership of women in the bands and societies, obviously because he was a faithful Anglican his whole life. He didn't really challenge the Church of England on that very strongly, but he did repeatedly talk about the leadership of women. His mother was a huge, Susanna Wesley was a huge spiritual mother and led small groups in Sunday schools and essentially led a church in their home without ordination.
Yeah.
But yes, Wesleyanism at its core is a very egalitarian, justice-oriented movement within the church, Catholic.
And that movement now probably wouldn't sit too well in a lot of evangelical spaces, right? Because it does seem like there's a widespread school of thought of both a non-egalitarian approach and also a non, we can call it social justice, but anything that is corporate justice, right, is like automatically liberal, which means it's automatically Marxist, which means it's automatically atheist, which means it's evil. That's like kind of how this the progression goes, right? Like you say, I want justice, people assume you're just, you know, you want to destroy America and just burn it down to the ground and whatever. It's been interesting, though, because the journey I've been on, as I've been thinking about, you know, the economy that we live in, capitalism, what it creates, this working class, you know, I almost feel I'm like, I haven't read a lot of Marx, but what I have read, I'm like, well, like the guy wasn't on some of these thoughts like super wrong. he wasn't right? that far off. But I feel like the Marxist thing is such a boogeyman word. You know,
it's
like me saying like I'm a Christian and I deny the resurrection. And people are, you know, it's like it's a very big deal. But like I think again from the little I've read, like Marx had valid points that capitalism can really create an economically enslaved working class that really props up a select few. And we see that more than ever now, right? I think the stat is the top 50 richest, you know, own as much wealth as the bottom 50% of Americans. Mm-hmm. It's like, well, it's happening. And I know that, you're passionate about this justice idea.
Yes,
so, so why don't you kind of give us your perspective on like the Christian and justice and like where you are with it?
So it is just so deeply ironic to me that so many Christians reject this idea of systemic justice and reject the idea of systemic injustice, which to me just reveals y'all didn't read your Old Testament.
I agree.
I agree. Because if you, what we get hung up on in Leviticus is we get hung up on like, I think incorrectly, sorry, my dog is whining. Come on, Scott. Fine.
No problem.
Come on, buddy. Where are you? we get hung up on like, well, and I think rightly so, we get hung up on the passages that talk about that we perceive as oppressing people, and we should get hung up on those and we should challenge those, but that's a conversation for another point. But what we see consistently throughout the Old Testament, we see it through the Pentateuch, we see it through all parts of the prophets, we see it through the writings, that God is deeply concerned with justice for persons who are oppressed. So you see throughout Leviticus over and over and over again, God makes provisions for people who are rejected by the rest of the world.
Right.
The aliens, the immigrant, the widow, the orphan. Which is not supposed to be an exhaustive list.
Right.
But is supposed to represent the most oppressed people in that time.
Right.
And so the question for us is, who are the immigrant, alien, widow, and orphan of our time?
Exactly.
And we see through the writings, right, through the history of the kings of Israel, that God is constantly like, y'all are screwing up because you are not upholding the rights of the immigrant, orphan, and widow.
Right.
And then we get to the prophets, and every single time it is about oppression. It is about abusive systems of capitalism, right? It's about abusive economies. It's about enslaving people and God challenging that. And in the instance of going to war against Pharaoh, that's straight up an ancient text of Yahweh going to war against another god and saying, you have committed oppression, so I am going to show you what genuine oppression and genuine freedom look like. And so then we see Jesus, as much as we might want to write justice out of Jesus, guess what, evangelicals? You can't. Because Jesus is a Jew. Jesus is Jewish. He is bathed in those texts.
Yes, he knows his tradition.
Importance. Yes, he quotes them all the time, and most frequently quotes the Psalms, which are all about celebrating God's justice. So in both the Old Testament in Hebrew and in the New Testament in Greek, even the word that we translate as righteousness in English means justice making. It doesn't have anything to do with just being pious. It doesn't have anything to do with showing up to church on time. It doesn't have anything to do with any of those markers of modern evangelical holiness.
Yeah.
That are miss markers, right?
Yes.
It's about it's righteousness is the one who enacts God's restoring justice. And throughout the Old Testament, even when we see God destroying things, destroying cities, destroying people, we always see that God is working towards a restorative option.
Yeah.
So we see, like with, I think of the prophet Jonah.
Yeah.
At the beginning, God says, doesn't matter. That doesn't say, tell them to repent and I won't destroy them. God just says, go let them know it's going to happen. And then the entire city changes to repentance and justice making. And God's like, yeah, we're not going to destroy them. It's great.
Right. Right.
And the religious person in the text, Jonah, is pissed off by this.
Yep.
He's just like completely, he says, I knew you were going to be abounding in justice and forgiveness and compassion. All those things are connected in the character of Israel's God. And so in Jesus, who is the incarnation of this Yahweh.
Right.
And then Paul even says he is the righteousness of God.
Yeah.
Jesus is God's justice is what that says.
Yeah.
That Jesus becomes God's justice for us. And so what does God's justice look like? Looks like Jesus healing the sick, welcoming the outsider, touching people that you're not supposed to touch, breaking holiness codes to welcome people to the center. And then God even rejecting the narrative of restorative violence.
Yep.
God rejecting all of those things and dying.
Yeah.
Upon a human institution of oppression from an oppressive regime.
Yeah.
He's literally executed by the state.
Yeah.
That's God's definition of justice. And then being raised to say you didn't win.
Right.
And if that's what God's justice looks like.
Yeah.
And what we see even in Jesus's healing, in the narratives of the gospel of Jesus's healing accounts, every single one of them addresses a systemically oppressed person. He heals a bleeding woman. She's a woman. She's constantly menstruating. And in that society, she can't even touch her own spouse.
Right.
She can't touch her kids. She can't cook for them. She can't even be in the house. If she is, she has to sit on a different chair.
Right.
Right. We see Jesus talking to the Samaritan woman. It's not a healing in the traditional sense, but it is a restoration of her to her community.
Yeah.
We see Jesus raising the dead. We see Jesus healing the sick servant of Jairus. Over and over again, Jesus goes out to those who are systemically and overtly oppressed by those around them, and then calls and is most critical of those who do the oppressing. So he calls to account the Pharisees, the Sadducees, the priests, everyone in Israel who held power. He calls them to account over and over and over again for the ways that they have not upheld God's justice as represented in the holy texts of Israel. So for Christians to say, right, systemic justice, which we might call social justice, that's the more common term for it, is not a part of the gospel, is nonsense. It's actually heresy, because it really, its roots go back to Gnosticism.
Yes.
Which the church decided a long time ago has no place in the church.
Right.
So Gnosticism, right, is the heresy of saying what we do with our bodies doesn't matter.
Right.
That there is a definite separation of spiritual and physical, and the physical realm can just go to hell.
Right.
And your spirit is untouched by that.
That's right.
That's a heresy. And it's sin when it is taking root in our lives. And as you just pointed out, that's exactly what the argument for electing Donald Trump by the evangelical right was. It doesn't matter what he does with his body. It doesn't matter what he does with our country.
Wow.
Because those are physical manifestations. Those are physical things. They'll be burned away. Doesn't matter.
Right.
We trust Jesus.
Right.
And we go on and vote for the Republican.
Right.
Candidate.
Yeah.
And all those things are tied together. We can't pretend they're not.
No, I mean, wow, that bit, so much, so good, so much to even unpack. Man, you know, I have a hard time understanding like why this big push against things that are obviously unjust. You know, I tell people, like, fallen people make fallen systems. Like, why wouldn't we expect systems to be like not perfect? Because we're people do bad things. Like we all know this. Mm-hmm. And it seems like no matter how much we look back at history to kind of show the receipts, I'm thinking right now of like systemic, racial injustice. Mm-hmm. And I would also say now more and more for me, economic injustice as well.
Yeah.
You know, we can look back and see all these times of how mm-hmm. many Christians were on the wrong side of that conversation. And it seems like now today Christians have this perspective of like, oh, well, that was then, like we fixed that problem. And mm-hmm. I'm just not that convinced, especially right. over the past like couple of years, seeing the George Floyd response by a lot of Christians, seeing the response to Black Lives Matter, you know, and I'm not extremely well read, but what I have read about like even American history, it's the same rhetoric being recycled, you know, the communism mm-hmm. boogeyman, the Marxist boogeyman. Like it's the same idea. They try to do mm-hmm. that with Martin Luther. They try to discredit him, calling him a communist. And so it's like, I just wonder, mm-hmm. like, what do we do about that? You know, because it seems like it's a very widespread right. issue.
So a helpful book that's very accessible for yeah. persons, regardless of like educational background.
Yeah.
It's called Jesus and John Wayne.
Oh, great book.
Great book. Yeah. And I think what was really transformative about that book for me is I've read widely about, right, like white supremacy as colonialism, right, as yeah. a knot, and as sexism as a knot, right,
yeah.
and heteronormativity as a knot, right. and economic exploitation as a knot. But it's actually all one knot.
Mm.
Yep. It's all one knot, not these separate issues within Christianity, within the world. It's all one. And what it really comes back to, again, is a part of it's Gnosticism.
Yep.
But yep. part of it is also, and that's why one of the reasons I love the Wesleyan tradition, is because it challenges this idea where we think being saved
yeah.
means Jesus died for me.
Yeah.
So I don't have any real genuine responsibility in the world
yep.
outside of I've said I'm sorry to Jesus.
Right.
That's about it. And maybe like, I'll apologize.
It's like a mental ascension. Like if I mentally yes. assent to this point, I'm safe.
Then I'm good. Yeah. Right. And instead, right, a Wesleyan, the technical term for it would be soteriology, which just means
yeah.
a study of our salvation
yeah.
For folks that might not know that.
Yeah.
But a Wesleyan soteriology talks about this idea of responsible grace. Yes, grace is a free gift of God. We do not earn grace. We cannot earn grace. We cannot deserve it. And precisely because it is free, God has invited us to participate in the yeah. kingdom building that yeah. Jesus inaugurated. Jürgen Moltmann, if anyone wants some more reading, that one's a little bit more meaty. But The Crucified God and all of his main works with that are just incredible.
I think about how Matthew Bates yeah. uses the word allegiance, mm-hmm. you know, like how faith yeah. is allegiance to a king. It's not just yes. about like this, mm-hmm. I can't see it, so I trust it. I mean, there's definitely an element of right. that, right? We're trusting in mm-hmm. resurrection that we weren't there for, but it's right. more about like my allegiance is to this king yes. Jesus that rules through subversion, not through power. And yes. then, like, how do we be a part of it that
yes.
way?
Yes. Yeah. And thinking about it even right, that it is embodied. By yes. nature.
Right.
Jesus is God in flesh, incarnate. Yeah, yeah. The salvation of humanity must also be in flesh, incarnate, must be lived out.
Yeah.
And if we try to separate those things, right, that Jesus's kingdom is just this pie in the sky that we get no matter what. Yeah,
totally.
Then what we end up with is a spirituality that has that doesn't want to do anything with social justice.
Right.
And I think that's part of it too, is if we think that if we participate in social justice, then Jesus won't come back as soon.
You're right.
And if we just let the world burn down and watch other Black men be murdered in the streets and other Black trans women be murdered in the streets with no repercussions, then you know what? If we just let those things happen, one, they probably deserve them. And two,
yeah.
then Jesus will come back sooner. And that is so, that has nothing to do with the gospel of Jesus.
There's a term, I'm blanking on it. I read an article about this train of thought that really sprung up in like, I think like the 1800s or, you know, it was mm-hmm. this idea of like, well, if things get real bad, God has to come mm-hmm. back. And it kind of has, you know, like you said earlier, this stuff is really one big knot. So I've heard both like, oh, we have to pray and act good for God to come back. And I've heard, oh, let it all burn till God comes back, right?
Yeah.
So I've seen both of those perspectives in the same knot. But there's, I'm blanking on the term now, but yes, I know exactly what you're talking about. It is this belief of like, well, the worst thing is the closer we are. And it's like, I don't think that is what we're supposed to be doing, like wanting the end of all things, you know?
Right.
I don't think that's the focus.
Yeah, like, and that just really ties into like dispensationalism, like the rapture and belief and everything there, right? Which is, that's a whole different conversation too. But
it is. But I mean, so here, I figured we could play a little game, right? I figured I can give you some of these lines I've heard from Christians who are, I'm going to say they're well-intentioned. I'm going to assume positive intent. And just kind of get your response to it, all right? And just be like, okay, like, what do you think? So like, for example, here's the first one, all right? Social justice isn't biblical justice, Tim. So Megan, what do you say to someone who says that? And by the way, that's, as you know, a very widely used little zinger over there.
I would say read your Bible. Like, and that sounds so trite, but I would say that I think they've confused biblical justice with like, judicial law and justice. Because what they're really meaning is by biblical justice is typically the bad person gets punished, and that's judicial justice in our particular judicial system.
That's right.
Biblical justice.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's very punitive. Which again comes back to how do we understand what Jesus did on the cross? If Jesus is taking a punch from God for me, then sure, punish whoever you want, God.
Right.
As long as it isn't me.
Right. We're safe.
Yeah. I'm safe. Jesus took my punch. I'm good, but you need to figure it out.
Right. Right. Exactly.
So yeah, I think I would just say like read your Bible. And every time it says the word righteousness, cross it out and write justice. And then come back and tell me what the Bible says about justice.
Yeah.
Looks like you need a vacation. Enter the 5-Hour Energy Where Will the Tide Take You sweepstakes. You could win a $10,000 dream beach vacation. Imagine jet setting off to a tropical paradise, having fun in the sun, or diving at a gorgeous reef. It's up to you. No purchase necessary. Go to 5hetide.com for official rules and to enter. That's 5hetide.com. Enter today. Ends June 30th, 2024.
No, I had this, I put like a challenge out on my Instagram account, you know, a little while ago. And I said, if someone can explain to me what this means, like, I would love to know. Because I hear it all the time, never hear it defined.
Right.
And they, a couple of people were like, hey, check out Ali B. Stuckey's podcast. I know, you know, Ali Stuckey, conservative commentator. And I checked out the episode. In fact, I even talked to Ali. Like, she gave me the episode to check out. And I watched the whole thing and I did a response video to it. You know, in real time, it's not out yet. But by the time this comes out, it probably will be out by then. And, you know, and I listened to her whole 45-minute monologue and honestly, like, was not very impressed in the sense of calling it biblical justice. Like, what she was really calling biblical was really, like, judicial and also very conservative with a couple Bible verses, like, picked out of context and sprinkled around to call it biblical. Right. Because we both know, like, you know, I could pick up, like, the laws about debt being erased every 7 years, right? And be like, look. Right. It's biblical justice. Every 7 years, that should be erased in America. It's biblical. So I do find that some of these arguments, it's not even, they're not actually, I would say, contextually scriptural. They are simply picked out to bolster the conservative viewpoint and then called biblical. So really, it's a hijacking of terms.
Yeah. Right. So to that point, Pew did research. Oh, it was even... Maybe it was right around the 2016 election. Might have been just before. But they did research and they actually discovered that people pick their churches based on their political affiliations and not on their theological beliefs. So what we have, right, is people aligning themselves with certain ideas about scripture, certain ideas about theology, certain ideas about God that already line up with what they already think politically.
Totally.
And like that has nothing to do with what they believe about God or what they think they should believe about God or how they've experienced God. They're saying, oh, that church sounds Republican. That church sounds Democrat. That church sounds this. That church sounds that. And that's how they're picking. And I think so much of that, right, has to do with like the religious right, which goes back all the way to the origins of this country, right? Which we have, like, we still have people trying to paint Thomas Jefferson as this deific Christian person. He literally kept a 14-year-old locked in his basement.
And like, also mocked the resurrection of Jesus. Like, he was not...
Mocked the resurrection of Jesus. He took scissors to his Bible. Let's just leave it alone. He's not that good of a person. Like, right. Even if you like his politics, then just say, I like his politics. He's kind of a creep.
Right.
And he owned how many people? Let's just stop there.
Right.
But I think part of the problem is that we have spent, so many evangelicals have for so long been bathed in this idea of religious right.
Totally.
They've been bathed in this idea, and they have been told over and over and over again that to not believe what they're being told means they're going to hell.
Yes.
And so for them, the stakes can't be any higher.
You're right. You're right.
And so they traded in, like, right, they traded in the ability to challenge that because they know what happens when you challenge that. Like, look at all of us, like, who have had to leave institutions. Totally. Look at all of us who have left churches. Look at all of us who are blasted online and treated like heretics. And goodness gracious, right?
Yeah.
They've seen what happens. And really, at the very heart of, if we listen to those narratives about like biblical justice isn't social justice, at the root of it is the fear that we are doing the wrong thing.
Right.
Right. That the church is out of its lane.
Right.
If the church doesn't have a lane in the affairs of society,
right,
then what are we doing?
Right. Or I would even say like a healthy role in society. I mean, like, I think the church is involved in society in like some of the worst ways possible, right?
Absolutely.
You know, the moral majority birthed this political movement that really is fighting for less freedom for most people and a lot more freedom for Christians, essentially.
Yeah.
Mass under the language of religious freedom, anti-tyranny, you know, freedom, whatever else. In fact, you know, it's funny. I interviewed a guy named Samuel Duth on my podcast a few weeks ago. He's a big anti-mask pastor. He has Candace Owens speaks at his church, that kind of thing. And he made a comment. He was like, you know, he was like, you know, we stand for freedom. And I said, well, for who? Like, for who?
Exactly.
And I told him, I said, would you say that telling LGBTQ people they can't get married in a country that isn't a Christian, you know, it's a democracy or a republic, isn't that like a violation of their freedom? And his response really wasn't that great, you know, because it's like, of course it is. Of course. Just because you don't agree with it doesn't mean that they shouldn't have a right to do it. And so I do find that interesting because I'm with you. It's like, and I would love your thoughts on this. I get stuck on this idea of like, I believe that Christians should be active in their society and maybe even in politics. But what I've been seen or what I've been shown, right, is the worst way to do that. So now I'm skittish. Right. Now I'm like, well, maybe Christians shouldn't be involved in politics because we really screw it all up, you know? Like, so what do you think? Like, how would a Christian with like that mentality of like kingdom participants, how would we get involved in politics that benefit all of humanity, not just me?
So there's actually a long history of this that it's kind of interesting. So the social gospel movement kicked off in the United States late 1800s into like the 1920s and on from there. But that was kind of like the hotbed of it. And the social gospel movement started all kinds of things like Catholic workers charities, all like the Red Cross, like all of these organizations that we're familiar with are kind of birthed out of this movement of Christians saying the gospel has something to say about society.
Yeah.
And has something to say with how we participate in it, which is exactly what the Wesley brothers were arguing as well, along with other simultaneous movements around the world. But so the social gospel movement was a part of this. Reinhold Niebuhr is a huge part of that movement. Bonhoeffer saw some segments of it when he was in the States. Famously said the only time he ever saw a real church in the United States was in Harlem during his visits. And I think that's also a really interesting aside with that is that oppressed people, particularly people of color in this country, but oppressed people who receive the gospel of Jesus have always been huge proponents of the church participating in society in a kingdom way.
Yeah.
That I think is really significant. Because it is when white, patriarchal, heteronormative, upper middle class persons center themselves with the gospel instead of centering a brown, oppressed Middle Eastern man in a empire that literally slaughtered him.
Yeah.
When we white people center ourselves in the narrative of the gospel, what we end up with is participation in society that reflects what we want.
Yeah, that's right.
And my allegiance to my race, my allegiance to my capitalistic enterprises,
right,
supersedes my allegiance to the gospel.
Right. My
property, I put more faith,
et cetera. Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so I defend my rights by standing at the end of my property with a gun when I see Black Lives Matter protesters walking by. And then I demanded the government protect me from any kind of persecution for that, right?
Right.
Or prosecution from that.
Right.
And
right,
I think and that's the key of the social gospel, is the social gospel centered the poor and said, Jesus told us to center the poor. Like, that's literally what he told us to do over and over and over again, is the blessed are the poor.
Right.
So they said, okay, then we're gonna take that seriously. And so the social gospel movement centered that. And that birthed great movements of the church. And I think sometimes it's really easy for those of us who grew up in evangelical traditions to not know about those things and to not know about the times that the church has done actually really faithful, good work.
Yeah.
Because we are overwhelmed by the news coming out of Canada, right? Like today, they just found another over 700 unmarked graves of Indigenous children that the Catholic Church just was using to erase their culture.
Yeah.
Right. That we should. I don't want to be misunderstood. We need to lament and we need to do right. And we do that when we center those voices instead of our own.
Yeah.
And I think that is the key to the church and followers of Jesus participating in politics, participating in society in ways that actually reflect the kingdom, is to not assume, well, I'm a Christian, so I have the handle on God. Even if those persons aren't Christians, this is another key confession of the Wesleyan movement, to say God's prevenient grace is there with them. God's grace that goes before saving is with them.
Yeah.
And God is at work in their lives, whether or not they're aware of it.
It really seems like, and I'm sure you thought about this too, the more I leave my white evangelical heritage behind, right? And I'm just trying to be faithful to this Jesus person, trying to figure that out. The more I'm like, wow, I grew up in a pretty self-centered system, right? That really centered me as the hero, that centered, you know, my material possessions, my rights, and also the Constitution as like central to being Christian. And anything that centered around voices that were oppressed or that were, you know, whatever, discriminated against, that was seen as like not good. But you're so right. Like, it doesn't take a scholar to read the Beatitudes and be like, oh, maybe I'm not at the center of anything that Jesus says, right? I mean, blessed are the poor in spirit, blessed are the meek, blessed are the peacemakers, right? Not blessed are the property owners or blessed are the capitalists, right? And it's interesting. I'm thinking about the book One Nation Under God by Kevin Cruz. He really documents how capitalism and like a national sense of piety of like, oh, faith in the public square, how they really merged, you know, like these big capitalists kind of got in bed with like that Christian movement. And that's how we have like One Nation Under God in the Pledge of Allegiance. That's how we have this idea of a good Christian stands up for their faith as if the God of the universe is protecting. That's crazy, you know? And so it is interesting, like, to see when you're in it, you don't see it. That's just normal, right? Like, that's just what it means. But as you start to kind of leave that matrix, so to speak, right? You're like, wait, that is completely,
this is insane.
It's insane. It's antithetical to, I mean, a healthy biblical interpretation. It's antithetical to a Jesus movement. It's also antithetical as well to even Orthodox Christianity in a lot of ways. You know, like it is. So how do you think, I mean, It's like, what do we do? I mean, that's right. That's like my next question, right? Is, okay, I'm in this thing. Actually, wait, hold on.
Right.
Let me stop you. Go. I have one more I want to do, one more little line.
Okay.
I forgot we're still playing a game. We're a little off track here. That's
we
my
got.
Bad. I have like one or two more. So another one I hear a lot is we are a country founded on Judeo-Christian principles. And again, the more I read American history, the more I'm like, that is clearly not true. But go ahead and give it to us straight.
That one kind of...
I'm sorry.
I had a visceral response.
Should have given you a trigger warning for that.
Yeah, seriously. Come on. Okay. So full disclaimer, right? I'm an ordained pastor, right? So I have simultaneously, like, as a pastor, what would I say to one of my like parishioners who came to me and said this?
Right.
And then like, what would I say to like my rando cousin on Facebook?
Right. Yes.
Right.
Yes. Totally.
Like, so I have those two views in mind. So I'll kind of try to say them both really succinctly.
Sure.
From like a pastoral perspective, right? I would say like, I know that's a narrative that we've heard of for a really long time. But actually, if we look at the founding fathers, the vast majority of them were not Christians. They were not Jewish. They were not Christians. They were deists. And in fact, were trying to remove themselves from Judeo-Christian values. Hence why we have the three-fifths compromise and only counting Black people as three-fifths of a person in the American Constitution. Hence why in the American Constitution, originally, women were completely excluded as well. And hence why in the American Constitution, we were literally colonizing people's land who already lived here.
Right.
All of that was not founded in Judeo-Christian values. That was founded in capitalism. Right. And sometimes, yes, capitalism can be leveraged for Christian norms, but in this case, it wasn't. It was just about making money for the empires of Europe. Right.
Right. Right.
So I would say that, right, that even look at the character of some of these persons. And that's not to say that persons who aren't Christian can't reflect Judeo-Christian values, but as we read their journals, as we learn about them, most of them didn't.
Right.
And the ones that were Christian, yes, they also sinned. And guess what? The Constitution of the United States isn't a part of the canon of the Christian faith.
Right. Absolutely.
It's not in the Bible.
Right.
It is no more inspired than any other nation's constitution. Right. So we could just as easily say, right, the constitution of like Sweden, a democratic socialist nation, is just as inspired as ours.
Right.
So I think that would be really important to note. Of course, if I was just blasting somebody on Facebook or making it would probably be like, Jesus literally said, you can't love both like God and money. And if we look at the history of our country and honestly look at it, our country isn't serving God. It's serving money and making itself money. And it's serving the military-industrial complex. That's not the gospel of Jesus.
You're triggering me now because I'm thinking about all these Facebook conversations I have with people. Because I'll share something, you know, like tax the rich or something like that. People are like, well,
eat
Tim,
the rich.
Like, yeah, or whatever. Yeah, eat the rich. People are like, well, Tim, like they earned their money, you know, like, well, Tim, you're envy's a sin, Tim. Or, you know, my personal favorite is when people are like, well, how much should you be taxed? I'm like, well, if Jeff Bezos is worth like, you know, 100,000 lifetimes of income for the average American and pays zero in taxes, it's probably not enough. Can we at least agree on that? And these are Christians. These are people who will read Paul where it says that, you know, neither the drunkard, the idolater, the greedy, the homosexual will enter the kingdom of heaven. Right, and they'll be like, oh, there it is. But the greedy, I mean, what is greed? You know,
I will also say that's a mistranslation.
You're right.
Paul doesn't say homosexual.
You're right. I'm using just like the stereotype, but you're correct.
That's fine. Yeah,
but you know, people who will use that verse to justify why they're anti those things, or homophobic, will also see that word greed and be like, well, we have to define it. Like, what's the cultural context? What is greed really? Like, all of a sudden, all these qualifiers come into play, and it really cracks me up because, like you said. Mm-hmm. I mean, we serve money in America. You know, I exist for a corporation to make them money, and I get a couple pennies to pretty much just survive in the world's richest country. It makes no sense.
Yeah. And I think, but like to pull back what you said earlier, right? Like if you read some of Marx now, you're like, oh, that makes sense, right?
I know.
That like, that's exactly what, like I heard this thing long, long ago. So I have no idea where it comes from.
Sure.
Right. But that essentially Democrats vote out of a fear that they could become poor, and Republicans vote out of hope that they could become rich. And let's not pretend the Democratic Party is faultless, because they are not.
Amen to that. There's no allegiance here.
No, but just kind of thinking through, even like, right, like thinking about tax codes and typically how how parties vote along those lines with tax codes, right? That like, and Karl Marx basically talks about the idea, right, that like these corporations, they convince you, they convince the poor that they could one day pull out of it. And yet, right, at the same time, these corporations are the ones driving all of the factors that systemically create poverty that is impossible to escape without assistance.
100%. 100%.
And then we have simultaneously, right, so many evangelical Christians want to make the comment, right, that like, well, I don't think the government should do it. The church should.
Right.
Well, I think Jeff Bezos, who has enough money to completely reverse climate change, to alleviate hunger globally, and still be pretty well off.
Right.
Tax him.
Right.
Tax him. He could still be so comfortable. I'm not saying move him under the overpass.
Right.
I'm saying use his funds to make the overpass just an overpass and not a house.
Exactly.
Right.
Right.
That he is making money in exploitative ways, totally, off of so many people that work for him who cannot afford to buy a house, cannot afford to do like have any major medical emergency, right? Yeah. That like, I think it's something like 80% of Americans are one medical emergency away from complete financial like collapse.
Yeah.
And that's not like, you know, that's not like, oh, I had to go through specialized treatment for this incredibly rare disease. That's like, I broke my arm in two places while playing in the park.
Yeah.
And also at the same time, like I lost my job because I couldn't work and because I needed surgery and reconstructive surgery and I can't type and da-da-da, right? Like it's like one thing.
Yep.
Like that's how messed up our system is. And so, yeah. But right, that's part of the lie of American culture. And lots of Black authors remind us of this. A lot of Black liberation theologians remind us of this, like James Cone, but many others remind us of the one of the myths of American culture is meritocracy, right? We continue saying that we earn what we have.
Right.
I didn't earn it. I was born to a middle-class family. By all accounts, I will probably die middle-class.
Yeah.
Right. Barring me winning the lottery, which will actually probably result in me going bankrupt.
Right.
Barring me, right, like marrying a multimillionaire, which I did not. I married a seminary student. So hashtag winning. right. Like.
Right.
But that's part of the myth of American culture. And that's how the system keeps, that's how the wheel keeps turning and crushing people, is that we keep telling people like it's earned and you can earn it and you can earn it. And
if you just work hard enough. It's like, listen, Jeff Bezos can't work hard enough to create his wealth. He has to have other people work for him. That's how that works. You know, like you have the same hours in a day, right? Let's say Jeff Bezos was a crazy hard worker and worked 100 hours a week, which would be insane for any human being, right? That's still only slightly over two times the work ethic of the average American who works full time, right? And you're telling me that he's somehow worth that many more. Not like, we're not talking about someone's richer than someone else. We're talking about such wealth gaps that they are actually affecting entire economies, right? Like Amazon's GDP, Apple's GDP, they're like top 10 countries. That's how big these transnational companies are, and they profit billions a quarter.
And they don't pay taxes.
And then when we say that, we're Marxist and not Christian. It's like, wait, what? Corporations aren't even people. Like they're not even made in the image of God. They're fallen systems. Why the heck can't we critique and say maybe we should be taxing them? And again, not to bankrupt them. They'll have plenty of money left over.
So much money left over.
Right, but if you're going to oppress the middle class, we better get something for it. You know what I mean? Like, it's crazy talk. So it does truly blow my mind that I'll say things like that and people are like, oh, you're a socialist. It's like, what are we talking? Are you crazy?
Right. But to your point, right, like socialism. We don't even know what socialism means, right? Like, you drive on a freeway. Socialism. Right.
We have police.
You're welcome.
Right.
You have police and firefighters, and you have, like, libraries, and you have schools.
Right.
Socialism, right?
Right.
But that is a boogeyman. But it was, like these boogeymen were intentionally chosen, right? Like the boogeyman of abortion, the boogeyman of like the LGBTQ community and AIDS, all of those were intentionally chosen to be boogeymen for the average evangelical by these evangelicals who make more money than God, right?
Right, right.
Like
right.
The Jerry Falwells and these groups pick these things. Scott, be quiet. This is my dog.
Hi, dog.
He is a mess.
It's all right.
These things were chosen on purpose.
Yeah.
Because they elicit fear because we don't understand them.
Yeah.
We don't understand Marxism. And I'm not saying Marxism as a system is the best system.
Totally.
But like tax the rich. Like right. That's not that hard. Feed the poor. Well, that's Jesus. Right.
I feel like because we were in this binary in America where you're either exactly. like your allegiance has to be all in or all out. You can't have nuance, right? So what we can say is, you know, Marx had some good points. I'm not, because that would get translated as, oh, you must be an allegiant Marxist who just wants to make the world Marxist. It's like, no, I'm just saying like, hey, there's some meat there.
Exactly.
We should ponder that, right? Capitalism might have some points that we should like take from, but like, yeah, that's a great point. But this like bowing down to the altar of capitalism, I mean, the way evangelicals talk about it, you would think it's in like Genesis 1:1. You know, like God created the heavens and earth and capitalism. It's like, no, these categories don't exist in the Bible.
And I think it just, right. Like we said, that like all of these are in one knot, right?
Yes.
This is a system of idolatry.
Yeah.
Right.
Right.
And so what we've done is we've said that God reflects what we value. And so God is a white man. God is a patriarchal slave owner. God is a heteronormative cisgender straight dude.
Right.
Right. Who thinks capitalism is the best. And maybe he looks like Jeff Bezos.
With an AK-47.
Right? With a bunch of AK-47s or whatever other kinds of guns God wants to have, because that's how God will win, is by being more violent.
That's right.
And I think because we traded in, like, let's just be honest. The calling of Jesus is really freaking hard.
Yep.
I don't really want to sell my possessions, give them to the poor.
Right.
I'll be honest. Area of growth for me. Hashtag. right. But that like the calling of Jesus is so radical, but we tried to make it so appealing to the wrong people that we sold it out.
Yeah.
And we exchanged, right? We exchanged this great treasure.
Yeah.
For the dirt on which it was buried, right?
Yeah.
And we think that evangelicals think that they've won something. But that's the constant struggle of the Christian church. I mean, it was co-opted by the Roman Empire under Constantine.
Yeah.
And for like ages the church like has talked about that as this good thing. And it wasn't.
Right.
It was actually really bad for the church and made the church a colonial oppressive regime.
Yeah.
Instead of a movement of people saying, hey, this Jesus called us to peacemaking. This Jesus guy called us to like lay down our arms. This Jesus guy called us to like center the poor and the oppressed. This Jesus guy called us to reject Roman ideals of patriarchy.
Yeah.
It's like all of those things that the Jesus story called us to, we rejected in favor of money and status. And I think, I mean, just like as a confession, right, that like, it's just as easy for those of us who have deconstructed and come on the other side of it and still claim Jesus to be like, well, now that I'm woke, I have this other status. You know what I mean?
Right.
And so like, and that's not to say that we shouldn't strive to be more woke and that we shouldn't strive for those things. But I think what's really difficult for me is to cultivate compassion for the persons who are still stuck in those systems.
Totally.
Because just as much as when I was in that system and all of this stuff was like, communism, you crazy people, right?
Right,
that's, and it's because they've been made to be afraid.
Yeah.
And like clergy have as much to answer for in that reckoning as any lay person does, because like so many pastors abused that and probably believed that and so proliferated it, but also many of them saw it as a golden opportunity. Like,
yeah,
I don't know Jerry Falwell. I hope he loves Jesus very dearly, but man, he figured out a really good system.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right.
And even like Billy Graham participated in that system.
Yeah.
Love to kind of deify too, right? That we have to begin to be honest and at the same time, find that compassion for persons who do trigger us, who do trigger that religious trauma.
Yep.
And like, that's really hard. I'm not an expert at that.
Yeah.
You know? But it's really at the end of the day, that's how we move forward, right? Is that the Jesus narrative still calls us to the kingdom work, even among the people that have pissed us off and pissed all over the gospel.
Right. I mean, that is loving our enemy, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, it is really hard. It's hard not to dehumanize people. It's hard not to be bitter. And I think it's a fine line between a righteous anger of like overturning temple, temple tables and money changers, tables, and then dehumanizing them and wanting them just to be torn down, right? Because they're still made in God's image. It's just frustrating to see when people claiming to represent God misrepresent him, take his name in vain, so to speak.
Like, tell me so, about it.
So, you know, egregiously, is that the right word for it? Egregiously? Something like that. You know,
gregariously?
No. That's not the right word. I do this all the time. My wife makes fun of me, or I'll just like say a word. I'm like, that's not the right word, but it's like a very big deal. You know, it's very widespread and it's very severe.
Yeah.
Absolutely. How they do this thinking that they're actually representing God. Well, it's like, what, what? But I agree with you
on that. And to your point, we have to continue to speak prophetically, right? Yeah. Forgiving them and loving them isn't being like, well, I guess they just don't know any better.
Right.
Like,
right.
You know, it is speaking out prophetically and saying like, no, that is not Jesus.
Yeah. I have the word egregious.
Okay. Ah, yeah.
I'm like, egregious? That's not right. Egregiously. That's what I was thinking of.
You ever have that thing where like you only have read a word and then you say it out loud and everybody's like, what are you talking about?
Oh, totally. That's why half the words I say are like super just like low level, like third grade level, because I'm too afraid to say the words I've actually read because I have no clue how to pronounce half of them.
Type it into Google and Google will pronounce it for you.
That's a great
hack. This is my new skill.
I mean, I used to look at the word Protestant and be like, Protestant? Like, I don't think that's
correct.
Well,
that's really where it comes from, so that works.
Well, Megan, we have a few more minutes. Last question for you, back to what I was asking before we got sidetracked. Like, what do we do going forward, right? I mean, I run this account. That's how you found me. It's how I know you. You know, people are deconstructing. They're trying to cling to Jesus. Mm-hmm. They want to be better Jesus people. They want to understand the Bible better. They want to have a rich spiritual life that is not Gnostic, right? It is interwoven with like the humanness, the body. And it's like, what do we do? A lot of us have either gotten kicked out of our churches or have left our churches. We feel like it's not a safe space anymore. And it's just like, wow, it can be very overwhelming. How do we move forward from your vantage point?
I mean, if I had like a single answer, I would also be a millionaire. but I think it's so multi-pronged. Because just as justice can't just be individual, but must also be corporate, so must spirituality, right?
Yeah.
And what I would say to that is we're like, I've gone through some pretty brutal deconstruction, where like I literally laid on my bed one night and was like, I just got a $120,000 degree and I don't believe in any of this anymore, you know?
Yeah.
And have gone through reconstruction. And in some ways, I guess I'll probably spend my entire life deconstructing and reconstructing. And I'm okay with that.
Right.
And I know not everyone is, but I am at this point in my life.
Yeah.
But what I would say is, right, Jesus said you can't put new wine in old wineskins. Not all of us can stay in the environments that traumatized us. Not all of us. And I would say most of us shouldn't stay in the environments that traumatize us. Not all of us can stay in church circles or denominations that do not reflect the Jesus that we are trying to follow. But there are a lot of really faithful traditions and non-denominational churches out there. And if even church is itchy for you, find a community of people that you trust and be like a Wesleyan band together. How is it with your soul? Because the image of God is not about me as an individual. The image of God is reflecting a triune community of three persons, right? So we are made in the image of community. We need it, both for our healing and our ongoing encounters with issues of justice and injustice. Because I need to constantly be challenged in my whiteness. I need to constantly be challenged in that. And I, as a woman, need to constantly challenge patriarchal norms with my simple, like, just by being in a space, right? That we need to do those things.
Yeah.
And I also need to have someone who reminds me, yes, and. And how is it with your soul? How are you taking care of yourself? How are you receiving the means of God's grace?
Yeah.
And we all need that. So I would say, first of all, community is so important. Even if that's a community online, literally COVID taught us nothing else other than, like, if it taught us nothing else, it taught us community can exist online and be genuine and true and be real.
Right.
So do that. So if you find people in the comments here, form a community, Zoom with each other, commit to it once a week. You know, I think that's so important. Remember to take care of your body. That is an act of spiritual discipline. Drink your water, do your sleep hygiene, take your meds, go to your counselor, get a counselor. Everyone needs one.
Amen.
Pastoral advice. Everyone needs a counselor.
Not your pastor, a counselor.
not a pastoral counselor, a counselor, period. Hi, that's my husband.
Hi.
Ryan, that you are so awkward, James. Go away.
You'll be on YouTube, buddy.
You're going to be on YouTube. You're welcome. Right. So I would say those are ways that we move forward. The prophetic act, the prophetic call out, those things matter. And also learn the humility of being called out if when you are also wrong.
That's good.
So I think those are some ways. On a corporate level, we as the church need to learn to confess and lament better.
Yeah, totally agree.
Not excuses. I think so many times churches and institutions are afraid of saying we really screwed up in the past. We really screwed up now. We really screwed up recently because they think that will harm the witness of the church. I would say not apologizing is a much worse way of doing that. So I'd say institutionally, we need to learn to apologize and lament. And that's something that individually we also really fail at. As Americans, we don't grieve well.
No.
We don't apologize well. We say, I'm sorry you made me do that.
Right.
But
right.
Thanks, T-Swift. So I think those are some of the ways that I would point to you, particularly with scripture. Find someone in your community, whether that's an online community or local community. There are lots of young pastors at churches who are like desperate to have a meaningful conversation with somebody about scripture in a way that isn't toxic and destructive. That's not to say all young pastors are trustworthy, because we're not.
Right.
But start there, or start with an online group of people, because a lot of us were only trained to read Paul from a reformed fundamentalist perspective. And that does a real injustice to Paul. And recapturing Paul completely changed my life, you know. Like, there's just so many different avenues that we can utilize to move forward. And I would guess I would also say with that, like, trust the movement of the Spirit. Don't fight the river. If the Spirit is the river, don't fight the river. Let the river take you where you're supposed to be. It will be uncomfortable, but it will be worth it. So
well, those are some great answers and a lot of food for thought. Where can people find you? Are you on social media? Do you have any, you know, any other platforms?
I'm a really bad millennial. I do have Facebook. I do have Instagram. On Instagram, I mostly post pictures of my dogs and nieces and nephew. But I'm always up for dialogue, and people can totally DM me and I will do my best to answer.
Great.
So yeah.
Awesome. Well, again, Megan, thank you for making the time and coming on and giving us so much wisdom and things to think about. It was honestly a great conversation, and I wish we had more time, but we'll have to get you back on maybe in the future and do a round two. Could be a lot of with Ben Kramer.
Ooh, Ben and I.
Yes. That could be great. All right. We'll talk. So thanks again.
Awesome. Thanks, Tim. Yep.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.